This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, July 29th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. On January 6th, the world watched in horror as a mob descended on the U.S. Capitol. In the immediate aftermath, politicians from both parties vilified the assault. But predictably, in the months since, the attack on the Capitol has become fiercely politicized. Plans by Democrats to organize an independent commission to investigate the riot were scuttled by Republicans. And when House Democrats convened a bipartisan select committee to hear testimony about the insurrection, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy attempted to populate it with Republicans who had rejected the 2020 election results. Former President Donald Trump has made several public statements decrying the committee and any Republican involved with it. Still, this week, the committee began holding hearings, allowing several people close to the riot to paint a vivid picture of the events of January 6th. Among them was D.C. Metropolitan Police Officer Michael Fanone, who attempted to defend the Capitol from rioters.
What makes the struggle harder and more painful is to know so many of my fellow citizens, including so many of the people I put my life at risk to defend, are downplaying or outright denying what happened. I feel like I went to hell and back to protect them and the people in this room. But too many are now telling me that hell doesn't exist, or that hell actually wasn't that bad. The indifference shown to my colleagues is disgraceful.
Susan B. Glasser, a New Yorker staff writer, joins me to discuss the Select Committee's hearings and how an attack on the Capitol became a partisan issue. Susan, welcome back.
Thank you so much, Dorothy.
The committee hearings were full of vivid, impassioned testimony, like Officer Fanone's. What particularly struck you as you watched?
Well, this was not necessarily revelatory in terms of new information that we received about January 6th, but I think it was meant to frame the mission of the Select Committee. And it was interesting for me, having watched so many videos and reconstructions and the entire impeachment trial of Donald Trump, all about January 6th, and yet the power, the raw power of watching these four officers recount in sometimes really horrifying detail what they personally experienced on January 6th was both powerful and also moving. And you heard a lot of the members on the committee itself really, I think, struggling with their emotions because it was such a raw and visceral day. It's the very beginning of the committee's work, and in a way, this was meant to kind of focus and frame why they're doing this, to provide a rationale for going back into this kind of traumatic and polarizing moment in our recent history. And I think they've signaled that they are going to be pretty aggressive in how they pursue the investigation. For example, it was reported this week that they're planning to go directly to subpoenas, not waste time trying to negotiate with potentially hostile witnesses to get their testimony, but essentially directly to go to people, including, by the way, the House Minority Leader, Kevin McCarthy, probably, and demand that they testify about what happened on that day and in the days leading up to it.
So let's talk about Kevin McCarthy and maybe go back to the days immediately after the insurrection, because I want to play a clip. And this is House Minority Leader McCarthy speaking from the House floor.
But should we also think for a moment, what do we put on social media? What do we convey to one another? Just because you have a personal opinion different than mine, you have a right to say it. But nobody has a right to become a mob. And we all should stand united in condemning the mob together.
Yeah. And yet, despite that rhetoric from McCarthy and other Republicans, when the vote to certify the election results resumed, 147 Republican members of Congress, who themselves had been directly under assault, voted not to certify. So was decrying the mob just a rhetorical move from Republicans, or was there any kind of genuine shift after the attack?
Well, you know, Dorothy, that I think in some ways is the part you can't investigate per se, but yet it is the political essence of this matter. Is the real Republican Party the party that said, wait a minute, this is horrifying, or is it the one that voted? And by the way, it was a majority, a big majority of Kevin McCarthy's conference, including McCarthy himself, who voted not to certify the election results, even as they were essentially standing on the shattered glass of their own workplace. You know, so is that the real Republican Party? It seems to me that the shock and horror of that day was real. But, you know, as we saw throughout the Trump presidency, you get used to even the unthinkable. You have members of Congress now, Republican members of Congress, who were at the same time that that hearing was happening, a small group of Republicans were in front of the Justice Department protesting what they called the political prisoners of January 6th. And so it's not just even that conspiracy theories among Trump supporters has sprung up about that day, but they're actively embraced now by actual members of Congress.
Sticking with McCarthy for a minute, let's flash forward to May of this year, when there were bills before both houses to establish an independent commission to investigate the insurrection. Kevin McCarthy made another statement, and that time he said, given the political misdirections that have marred this process, given the now duplicative and potentially counterproductive nature of this effort, and given the speaker's short-sighted scope that does not examine interrelated forms of political violence in America, I cannot support this legislation. What happened between January and May that made McCarthy so decisively shift his rhetoric?
Well, once again, Donald Trump happened. And interestingly, the reason they want McCarthy to testify, I should be clear, is because he made a frantic phone call to Donald Trump, which he then told another Republican about, a Republican who ultimately was very critical of Trump on January 6th, and essentially pleaded with Trump to do what Trump would not do, which is to call off the mob. And he was furious with Trump, according to his initial recounting of it. And yet, within weeks of the attack, he was flying down to Mar-a-Lago, once again seeking Trump's support. These days, I have to say, having watched Kevin McCarthy for a long time, he's practically unrecognizable. He's tweeting trollish sort of Tucker Carlson type rants about pandemic mask requirements and things like that. He's basically gone even more Trumpy, arguably, than he was during the Trump presidency. And I think it's a reflection of his House Republican conference, which is in some ways even more extreme than it used to be, which is a classic thing, right? If you're in the minority, you shrink down to your most hardcore members. And so you have, in some ways, a more extreme version of the party reflected in its elected officials at this moment.
Right. So under McCarthy's leadership, Republicans effectively killed the effort for an independent commission. In response, Democrats in the House convened a select committee. Can you briefly explain the difference between an independent commission and a select committee?
Well, you know, an independent commission is what we have done in recent history in all sort of big national tragedies or events. For example, this commission they wanted to have was basically modeled on the 9/11 commission. The idea is that you would get prominent figures from all across the political spectrum to come together to reach one commonly accepted set of the facts. And of course, the great tragedy of this moment is that we won't have that on something we need arguably more than anything. And, you know, interestingly, they came close in the Senate, but it really was in the Senate where this commission was blocked. And for a different reason, I think that in the Senate, it's like they don't want to talk about it. Many of the Republican senators, they just want to move on. The House is an even more fractious, polarized environment at the moment. And I think what you see there is in the House, the fear was turning it into another political circus. And so that's why a commission would have been more independent. You would have had an independent staff and ideally, again, one commonly accepted set of the facts. Now, a select committee, it will have many of the same powers to subpoena information from witnesses and documents. But at the same time, Republicans will have the built-in ability to say, this is just partisan, it's just a witch hunt. You know, you can imagine all the things that they'll say. And even more so, because Kevin McCarthy tried to appoint members to the committee, many of whom had voted against certifying the election results and who essentially were determined simply to burn down the panel. And for the first time ever, Nancy Pelosi exercised the powers of the speaker and vetoed his choices. And so it's really, we're in kind of uncharted waters.
Well, and what was McCarthy attempting to do by appointing, in particular, Jim Jordan of Ohio and Jim Banks of Indiana to the committee, knowing that Pelosi would object?
They wanted the whole technique here. There's a well-established playbook for it. And essentially, it would be to turn it into a partisan circus, to sow muddy the waters and to make it, frankly, into enough of a clown show to discredit any damaging results or information that the committee would produce. And that is the reason why Pelosi vetoed that.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
Despite all of the political acrobatics, the Republicans have not put forward a reasonable defense of the events of January 6th. They've tried to blame Pelosi, as you mentioned, for somehow failing to lead the Capitol Police, not her job. They've vaguely accused Black Lives Matter protesters of inciting the riot. They've attempted to recast the insurrectionists as political victims of a deep state conspiracy, and on and on. Are any of these narratives catching on in a broader way?
Well, look at the numbers, and that's where it's worrisome. Of course, there's not a majority of Americans who support these alternate facts, quote unquote, that are being offered. That was always true about Donald Trump in general. It's a significant minority of the country who have become his fanatic followers, and millions of them believe to this day that Donald Trump was a legitimately elected president in 2020. Many of those people believe that January 6th was not an insurrection or a coup attempt against the constitutional transfer of power. And so there is an audience for this, and especially because it's amplified day in and day out in the echo chambers of conservative media, not only by some of Fox's prime time hosts, but by even more extreme channels such as OAN and Newsmax that have become the new favorites of Trump because he sees Fox as, generally speaking, not loyal enough to him anymore.
So even though he has become a lot less visible to the general population in the months since he lost his Twitter account, he has these other outlets. And he also still holds rallies. He summons the anointed to Mar-a-Lago, and he does maintain this stranglehold on the Republican Party. How has he exerted control over the various January 6th inquiries?
Well, you know, I think you're really right, Dorothy, to spotlight this media ecosystem that continues to support Trump and amplify him, even though he's been turned off of Twitter and Facebook and the like. You know, in sort of blue America, he's receded as a daily presence, but that has not had the effect of severing him from his fanatic fan base in red America. He remains a huge fundraising force in Republican politics. Another thing that happened in the last few years that maybe didn't get as much attention as it should is the structural takeover of state and local Republican parties by pro-Trump forces and forcing out more establishment or non-Trump Republicans. And so Trump has an enormous loyalty in the infrastructure now of the Republican Party. So, you know, he has some levers of power that remain. The main one, I would say, is psychological. He is in the heads of these politicians who truly believe that without him, they wouldn't have the political power that they have.
I mean, this is just so worrisome on so many levels. And it does seem as though, from what you're saying, that Blue America continues to be dismissive of a lot of these, you know, theatrical undertakings that we've been witnessing. So you talked about the rally in front of the Justice Department held by Republican Representative Matt Gaetz, Marjorie Taylor Greene, and others, you know, demanding the information about what they call political prisoners. The rally was shut down by protesters who blew a loud whistle and heckled the representatives.
...who are being targeted by law enforcement, and if there's a basis for that, then we have to make sure that we get it. That's why we're here answering these questions. Honored to be with my colleagues, and we now turn it over.
So it was easy to just kind of dismiss all of that, but we've laughed at and dismissed movements like this before, and they turned out to be incredibly dangerous.
Well, that's right. I think part of the confusing phenomenon of Trump era reality show politics, right, is that just because it's clownish doesn't mean it can't be dangerous. And I think that's, you know, trying to figure out the balance between those phenomena is one of the ongoing problems. It's a minority, but it's a significant and very hyper-empowered in our politics minority that continues to look to Trump and to make loyalty to him kind of the litmus test of the party. And of course, you see that in a very tragic manifestation when it comes to public health. Look at the map of America right now. Look at it in terms of the partisan divide. And then look at the map of where this coronavirus outbreak is occurring among the unvaccinated. And, you know, it's almost an exact overlay.
Well, and interestingly, even Sean Hannity now has come around to vaccination. On Monday, he said, please take COVID seriously. I can't say it enough. We don't need any more deaths. So is there an outer limit to the effectiveness of alternative facts as these unvaccinated people in red states continue to be hospitalized at alarming rates?
Well, that's an interesting question. You have seen a little bit of a shift from people like Hannity or Fox News is promoting a public service announcement urging its viewers to get vaccinated. At the same time, it still features hosts like Tucker Carlson and Laura Ingraham, who every day are criticizing the vaccine, are basically acting as though mask mandates are some sort of form of totalitarian, you know, invasion of your body and your home. And so, you know, I think a lot of the damage of this vaccine misinformation, of course, is done. I mean, you know, it's a tragedy that this fourth wave is occurring after we have had within our power the means to stop it from happening.
Also, interestingly, yesterday, in the face of Trump's strenuous opposition, the Senate announced a bipartisan infrastructure deal, which means that the debate over the bill and the amending process will begin. The timing can't be coincidental, but only 17 Republicans voted yes. So what is the significance of all of this?
Well, you know, it's fascinating, actually, like, that only 17 Republicans voting yes, in some ways, was the biggest victory for bipartisanship in quite a long time. And I think, especially because one of those 17 was Mitch McConnell, the Senate minority leader, this is being seen as a very significant moment and an indicator that part one of Biden's even more ambitious infrastructure plans is likely to pass now. That doesn't mean it's done. You know, this is the Senate. There's endless procedural hurdles. What it means is that they can move forward with actually introducing the bill and giving us, you know, basically a debate on the floor on the bill and its various provisions and various amendments that will then be allowed. So it's a very significant hurdle that was cleared. And so I think it was very interesting to see McConnell giving the green light to move forward on this bill. And, you know, that reflects a big difference between, you know, the House Republicans and the Senate Republicans. They really have different theories of the case right now about how to deal with Donald Trump and the enduring legacy of Trumpism on their party. McConnell is certainly was a big critic of January 6th, although he did not vote to convict Trump in the impeachment trial. He also was against the January 6th commission for the very specific reason that he wants to move on. He doesn't want it to be Trump's Republican Party anymore.
It's a little late now.
Well, that's exactly right. But in politics, Dorothy, it's never too late. They are of the camp of the hold our nose and get what we can get out of the Trump presidency school of Republicans, which was always, you know, a key grouping in the last 4 years in Washington. They were key enablers, of course, of Trump and his legislative agenda, and especially, McConnell believes his entire legacy will be how he leveraged the Trump White House and the Trump presidency to install an entire new generation of very, very conservative judges on the U.S. federal courts and on the Supreme Court. In the House, you have a much more kind of fanatically and publicly pro-Trump fan base. And in some ways, Trump is much more properly seen as a kind of a creature of the extremists in the House Republican Conference. And so it's just fascinating to see the kind of different camps of Republicans that exist right now in Washington when it comes to what's going to be the future of the Republican Party. And do you engage with the White House in something like this infrastructure bill is a fascinating way of kind of seeing what the different approaches are.
It is. And all of this is so clarifying. Thank you so much, Susan.
Thank you, Dorothy.
Susan B. Glasser is a staff writer at The New Yorker, where she writes a weekly column on Biden's Washington. She and Peter Baker recently published The Man Who Ran Washington, The Life and Times of James A. Baker III. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for newyorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.